an AdTech podcast. News of the week in AdTech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the MadTech podcast from ExchangeWire. I'm John Still, ExchangeWire's head of content, and I'm pleased to be joined today by ExchangeWire CEO, Rachel Smith. Rachel, welcome.
Hello, I'm becoming a podcast regular again.
You're back frequently on, but yeah, as always, lovely to have you. I'm also delighted to be joined by a very special guest today, Sonia David, head of strategy at Dentsu Singapore. Sonia, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Happy to be here. First time ever, but happy to be here.
Great to have you. Thank you very much for joining us today. We will dip right into our first story, I think. And this one is going to be about Meta and data sharing. Meta has apparently pledged to allow its Facebook Marketplace customers to opt out of having their data used by the company, as well as limiting how advertising data is used for its own development. The Competition and Markets Authority reported that Meta's signing of commitments to not use its advertising customers' data removes the risk of the platform having an unfair competitive advantage. Meanwhile, the commitments secured from Amazon will also ensure third-party Amazon marketplace sellers can compete on a level playing field. Amazon's commitments will come into force within 6 months. Rachel, I will come to you on this story first. How does this news impact Meta's relationship with advertisers, do you think? How's this going to work out?
So I think that this is good news from an anti-competition point of view. So it's good news for advertisers in Facebook Marketplace and in other marketplaces in general, including Amazon. Is it news that just relates to the UK, or have they agreed that they're going to do it in other markets? I had a feeling that it was just the UK Competition Authority, but might be wrong on that. In any case, I suppose what I'm interested in is the detail of exactly how they will provide the opt-out option for consumers in that environment. So the whole idea is that it's based on consumers moving around in the Facebook marketplace and obviously having the option to opt out. Is it going to be automatic opt out or is it going to be automatic opt in? So that's the first point I thought would be pretty important and interesting. And then secondly, then that is also, it's also based on the premise that once consumers opt out, Facebook obviously won't capture that data and won't use it for their own purposes to refine the products that they're looking to advertise and sell elsewhere in the marketplace, thereby creating an unfair advantage over other advertisers that are advertising in that marketplace. So the thing I found really interesting about this, I was looking on the UK government's website that's given a really quite detailed press release around the decision that the Competition Markets Authority made, is that they're actually, Facebook have agreed, or rather Meta, I should stop calling it Facebook, have agreed to independent trustee, that's not the word, not independent, monitoring trustee, that's it, who's actually going to not just be monitoring how this, non-data sharing practice is going. So they'll be periodically auditing files to understand whether Meta have actually not captured data in the way that they said they were not going to, as long as consumers have opted out. But they're also going to sit in on staff training, and they're going to have some oversight of any of the technical systems that are designed to limit the use of advertising data in the development of Facebook's own products within Marketplace. So it's actually quite a sophisticated set of measures that have been put in place. So I'm really interested to know if that's happening outside the UK, or if this has mostly been in the UK, and then how that's actually going to impact Meta's marketplace products. And the reason where I'm going with this is that, you know, the whole point of those marketplaces, whether it's Facebook Marketplace or Amazon, is the support that they provide to SMBs to really grow their customer base beyond a much wider footprint than they'd be able to manage, you know, if they were just selling, if they were just selling products either within their own site, if they happen to be a digital first business, or selling them, you know, in a bricks and mortar store. And so you know, I think that this will, this should, from what I can see, it's designed to bake the whole principle of competition in those marketplaces into Facebook Marketplace and Amazon and others. And I hope that's the case, because that's the whole point of, you know, the internet was trying to democratize access for businesses to prosper, as well as to get, you know, information and products to a much wider audience. So that's what I hope that it does for brands and advertisers, is protects their business and their products and enables them to continue to grow. And I hope, even if it is just specific to the UK, I hope that it's a precedent that gets set up and, you know, and other marketplaces, other global marketplaces follow, because I think it's good for business and it's good for, and it's actually good for marketplace products.
Yeah, just for clarity, this is from the UK Competition and Markets Authority. So we're talking from a UK perspective here, but obviously there are global implications for other markets going forward. Sonia, how do you see this from your point of view? Does this represent a victory for some consumer privacy? How do you see this affecting Meta's relationship going forward?
I'd say this is quite early days in the space of consumer privacy. We're still trying to figure out what is the extent to which we can have privacy for consumers and yet have them get those customized experiences, personalization, all of those things come into play. And it's a very delicate balance that has to be made per product. For every consumer who chooses to give their data, there is always another three more who choose not to give their data. And it's a question of, you know, what works for one will not necessarily work for another. But when it comes to advertisers per se, advertisers are in the process of collecting their own first party data. They're in the process of, you know, investing in that data, because they see data as kind of the fuel that is going to run a lot of the business and a lot of their marketing efforts, a lot of their effectiveness of any sort of effort they put into growing the business. So that's going to be really important for them. The question is then, how are they going to use that? What are the engines and levers they're going to use? And is Facebook going to be set up to use that data the right way, in a privacy compliant way, coming from marketers as well? And what does it mean if you give a marketer your data, then when it goes to Facebook, how does that interact to create better targeting for the marketer, but doesn't improve Facebook's own product? Because that's kind of a, you know, it's a technical question in terms of how you set out those, I'd love to say walls, but I expect there'll be more like membranes rather than walls between those things, in terms of making sure that you have these places, you know, and these barriers between all of that. When it comes to marketplaces, I think fair competition is always good for consumers, and marketers will always appreciate that, you know, because we see that the rise of the entrepreneur, the rise of the organic business that's coming in and challenging big business. It's kind of a David and Goliath situation that you see coming in. And a lot of them have called out Amazon for its practices in the past. So it must have reached a stage where Amazon felt, you know, and it feels kind of reactive in a way, that Amazon felt the heat of such a thing and felt the need to kind of level the playing field, so to say, so that they made sure that, you know, the small players do not leave their platform and choose to go elsewhere, but maintain their spaces and maintain their brands on those platforms, because that's what also gives them the credibility about having that vast access in the market as well. So those are things that will be really important, and what they might have been taken into consideration when they look at that. Obviously, there are business implications all around for everyone. But yes, I think we will only, as we go forward, we will only see how this pans out in the space of how everybody gets to activate with data, share data, and basically use a partner's data.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that element of, you know, how will this actually, you know, technically be achieved is really important. That's why I found it really interesting that they had agreed to the appointment of this monitoring trustee that's going to oversee the implementation of any technical systems that are designed to, you know, restrict the use of ad data derived from display advertising in Facebook Marketplace. That's fascinating, right? Like, I don't think that, and I certainly don't think that's something that Meta would have even contemplated, you know, sort of five, 6 years ago, but I think the world of protecting consumers' privacy has just become so much larger and so much more serious that this is the set of circumstances we're now in. And yeah, I think some of the other things you mentioned there, Sonia, are also really interesting, because on last week's podcast, I was chatting with the CMO from Trapo, which is a online car accessories marketplace, and he was talking about it was related to TikTok as a sort of a commerce platform, and he was talking about the ban in Indonesia and how there will be a real there'll be a real pressure on the Indonesian government to rethink that, because it's a marketplace that has been provided for millions and millions and millions of businesses and consumers, and united the sort of expansive Indonesian archipelago in a way that has never been achieved by any other website, there may well be other competitors to TikTok, other platforms that could rise up and do something similar. But the point he was making is this is a really important point for consumers and a really important point for businesses, small, medium enterprises. So it's just a super fascinating space at the moment.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you bring up Indonesia, because when you get into it, you realize that there's two sides to it in terms of how they've been looking at it. One is so many small-time entrepreneurs have set up shop on TikTok, right, in terms of selling up this thing. But for them, the government has put in place this regulation talking about how it affects the industries that are based in Indonesia versus the resellers in Indonesia, right? And it comes down to who do you want to support? Because they are both small businesses. They just have conflicting, ways of making, their business work and how their growth comes in. And honestly, there is no silver bullet that's going to make it okay for both. Someone's going to lose on some aspect and someone else is going to lose on another. But it definitely is a space in terms of, are we then saying that original manufacturers only should have space on marketplaces? And that's a completely different conversation altogether. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be an interesting space to watch.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating area. One that's, we'll all be keeping an eye on. I expect to see a lot more news like this flooding through over the next 12 months. As I do with AI as well, which is our next story, we are going to hear about the OpenAI chatbot, which is being trained for the first time on new information. The OpenAI chatbot is going to be trained on information up to April 2023, CEO Sam Altman announced this week. When ChatGPT was launched a year ago, it only had the ability to answer questions based on archives of information up to 2021. Following this new training, the chatbot will also be able to digest more context, accept images as prompts, and even write code in a specific language. It's a discussion we're having an awful lot, Sonia. I'm sure you are as well. Can generative AI keep changing the game? How is this going to impact our industry?
Well, I think generative AI has to keep changing the game. It is so new and nascent, right? I remember that, when we had the time when social media came out and when the internet came out, and we looked at it and said, oh my God, look at the wild, wild west. And there's so no rules about here. And that's where we are right now with generative AI, right? We're still, in the words of someone, flying the plane as we build it.
That's a very good analogy, yeah.
So it is going to have to keep changing as we talk about it, because there are definitely ethical concerns that have to be addressed. And as you build it, you have to fix some of those problems. Otherwise, you run the risk of making some of the mistakes from the past that we have seen with new technology that comes in, that unites people, that solicits opinions from everywhere. Sometimes democratically and sometimes skewed towards specific areas more than others. We've seen this in the past, and there was it was very long time back that we looked at a Twitter bot that decided to answer questions that people post to it, and that didn't go too well, right? So it's a question of what you put in. So I actually attended a generative AI session, a training session with Google sometime back, and they kind of said, it was a very thought-provoking thing that when they showed us two pictures of two parrots, and they said, this is a picture of a parrot that was created by a person who just wanted a picture of a parrot. And then here's a person who gave so much of detail into what they wanted the picture of the parrot to be that it came out with a pirate hat and a glint in the eye. And, the whole picture told its own story. And that basically brought me to the point, you know, the realization that it's only as good as you put it. So prompt engineering is going to be such a big thing. And whatever you train it on, I sure hope the world has changed a lot between 2021 and 2023, you know, so that you can see a difference in the results. But I think we're going to have to change the world to change the kind of outputs that come out as well.
Yeah, it's so, you know, you hit on a good point there that it is only as good as what you put in at the moment. Rachel, how do you see this shifting the advertising industry, the ad tech industry?
Well, I think you should say it's only as good as what you put in, because I thought I'd run a little experiment and ask ChatGPT, how can generative AI keep changing the game? So I'm just going to read you the little answer that it put out for enjoyment. Generative AI is like the magician of the tech world. It keeps pulling new tricks out of its virtual hat. One big game changer is its ability to create content autonomously, from art and music to text and even code. This not only saves time, but also opens up creative possibilities we might not have thought of. Imagine a world where AI helps us brainstorm ideas, design products, or compose music. It's like having a creative sidekick that never runs out of inspiration. Plus, generative AI can learn and adapt, getting better over time. This means it's not just a one-trick pony, it's a whole circus of possibilities. And I thought to myself, circus is right. Like, it's, you know, and I think that just, you know, feeds in perfectly to your point, Sonia. It's, you know, it's prompt based, right? So it's as good as what you put into it. So you give it something general and a little bit sort of, kind of reflective. You give it a general and reflective question, it gives you a general and reflective answer back, right? So how is it going to, back to your question, John, how is it going to impact the world of advertising, even in the, you know, even in the prompt response that it gave there? I think there's no denying that it's going to be hugely useful for improving efficiencies around repetitive administrative tasks that are annoying for pretty much anyone that has to do them. Great. Personally, I'm really looking forward to a world where I have to do less of those things and where something can do it for me. That's brilliant. Can't wait. And I'm already using, you know, some form of generative AI for administrative tasks that I think it can, you know, handle for me, which is great. But that also, the prompt response it gave me made me think one of its other big benefits will be the lack of exhaustion, right? Like, it has this sort of, you know, promise of endless possibilities, very heavily dependent on exactly what you said, Sonia, which is the quality of questions you ask it and prompts that you give it. So could it really change? Could it be a real game changer for the sort of creative production and, you know, idea facilitation side of advertising? Yeah, I think there's a possibility for that. And certainly we discussed that at ATS Singapore this year. And it's, you know, it's a topic that has been at the forefront of everyone's minds, because they pretty quickly go from that question to, does that mean that it would replace humans and we're no longer listening to music that's been created by individual humans, but rather being created by AI? I just think we're so far away from that world. The interesting part is flying the plane while we're building it. And that's what we're doing now, right? So I think the answer is yes, it can have a huge impact on all of those things. I think, used in the right way, to our benefit as a society and as a bunch of individuals, but nothing will ever replace, I know this isn't the question, but nothing will ever replace the human individual element that's required for all of those things to be satisfying, for creative production, you know, for artistic direction. All of those things are not just the purview of talented people that are capable of it. They're also importantly consumed by people that are not even remotely creative, but enjoy the experience of, you know, listening to music, looking at art, admiring art, watching film, all of those sorts of things, reading books. And I just don't, yes, it's so yes, it's going to change advertising, I think, hugely, hopefully for the better. We're really far away from dramatic change, and it's fascinating to watch it unfold as we go along.
Yeah, to paraphrase something I saw on social media recently, when we talked about a brave AI future, I didn't expect to be filling in spreadsheets while the robots made the music and wrote the poetry. You know,
it's
going to
be the exact opposite. You're totally right, John. That's what I'm expecting. I'm expecting no more spreadsheets and way more time to sit around and enjoy music and film and books.
Yeah, I thought it would, you know, write the articles while I learned the violin or something like that. But no, we are entering a brave new world where it can also make music.
Yeah.
Sonia,
yes, I want to be a little bit of a devil's advocate, Rachel,
please.
What you said, right?
Yeah.
So in order to do all of these tasks, you're going to have to give access to that AI to your data. And it seems like I'm going a little bit back to the previous topic, but they are interconnected. Because if you want it to do things for you, you want it to make appointments for you, you want it to be able to do, you know, kind of like give you suggestions on what you can do, you're going to get access to your data. And suddenly that conversation goes back to the previous one on privacy. Like, minute I, whatever I put out there and I give to an AI, is it mine or is it open for everyone else to generate and build on? Mm. Right. So the competitor factor, the ownership of your data, the privacy things, all of those things have to be taken into consideration in terms of what you're putting in and who else can access it and how do you create those boundaries around it. So I'd love to have a generative AI tool behind my Siri that's literally going to go and, you know, find out all the information I wanted. The next time I go, okay, you know, Siri, where's this? What's that like? You know, I can get a very nuanced answer rather than sometimes the jokes that we play and, you know, the kind of fun that we have with it. The question is, where is all that data coming from? Mm-hmm. And whose data are you giving to me? You know, and that becomes a bigger question in terms of those regulatory bodies that we spoke about as well. And it's a bigger problem for marketers because where does my data go? And does it go to my competitor or does it go to, you know, someone else? So marketers and advertisers are going to have to think really a lot around how they create those walled gardens of sorts around their data so that generative AI can actually work with it.
Absolutely. And regulation is just a huge area that, you know, that needs to speed up super quick to try to help us take control of this and create some guardrails. And there's so many moral and ethical dilemmas associated with this as well that we haven't come anywhere near close to properly contemplating, let alone solving as a human race. And, you know, I was just thinking about it as well as we've been chatting, if we apply it to something like, you know, creation of music. And I think about how music's always been such a massively important feature in my life. I came from a family of people that played instruments and music was always on in our family household, either being played individually by someone that was playing an instrument or on the radio or on the record player when I was growing up. And so we're all, you know, it's been such a fundamental part of my life and I grew up consuming it in such a different way to the way I consume it now because it's not available in the way that it was when I was growing up. You don't walk into a record store and filter through records and, you know, ask to listen to a few seconds of something you've not heard yet before. Instead, you consume everything digitally. It's all at the, you know, at the end of my fingertips whenever I want to. And in fact, I'm listening to the radio and I hear a song that I like and I just quickly even Google a couple of the words. And next thing you know, I've downloaded it onto a Spotify playlist and it's amazing. That's really satisfying from a consumption point of view. But what does it do to the creation of music? And alongside that debate of how consuming music has changed has been, well, you know, is a song as, can an artist be credited for the same degree of, you know, sort of ingenuity if they're using a lot of digital tools to help create their song as Paul McCartney and John Lennon were back in the 60s when they were writing Beatles tunes? Like, is it the same thing or is it not the same thing? And the answer is it's not the same thing. And then ensues a whole debate about how it gets created, who owns it. And yeah, that is a deep debate that we haven't even got tapped the surface of.
And it's very interesting because I remember there was a court ruling recently about images created with AI that you cannot copyright or trademark them. So when it comes down to music, that's a whole different ballgame altogether where everything is all about the rights.
Yep.
And, you know, everything's all about the rights because that's how people make money off it, right? So that's how the artists make money off it, but that's also how the contractors make money off, you know, and that's a whole other podcast.
that's definitely a deep dive podcast that we might have to do at some point in the future.
I think it's a great idea. Can we get Paul McCartney on for it, maybe?
I think I'll put in a call and see if we can bring him on. Yes, I'm going to move us on to our next story from a technology that looks to be sticking with us from some time to one that had a very, very quick hype cycle, but seems to be maybe on the way back up. NFTs are still promising for brands, despite the rise and the fall of the hype, apparently. So despite this wavering hype, a report has found that businesses and institutions continue to have confidence in the benefits of NFTs. According to Bain & Company, NFT adoption has been constant since June 2022, demonstrating continuous mass implementation, which should continue. Sectors which have increasingly developed NFT-backed applications include sports, ticketing, luxury, retail, gaming, and art. Their reliance is said to be expanded accessibility, transparency, convenience, accuracy, and fraud protection. So as I mentioned, they were seen as a bit of a flash in the pan. There's been a lot of fluctuating value in some of the headline NFTs recently. Sonia, do you think NFTs can still be a valuable proposition for brands now?
I think most definitely. NFTs are turning into currency around authenticity, like you said, right? It's about making creativity exclusive in a way. How do you make sure that other people get access, you know, ownership of a creativity? So between that thing for authenticity and ownership, there's a lot of space to play where NFTs can come into it, and actually see how they could grow in those thing, especially for brands and categories that place an additional value on that. So like you said, the categories that they're looking at, especially when you're talking about luxury, retail, gaming, art, all of them are so much about celebrating the individuality, the uniqueness of a certain experience, the uniqueness of a certain product. The authenticity is what gives it the value in those spaces. And NFT is all about that. So there definitely is a lot of space for it there. I think when we talk about, can I get NFT and does it have a connect with the shampoo that I bought yesterday? Probably not. But then I think there are nuances around different categories that some of the technology can speak to, and some categories it just won't work.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was obviously, you know, I was being slightly glib with my introduction to NFTs because of the headline stuff, basically the value of some of the images that was hyperinflated and then dropped very quickly. But obviously there is that utility. We've talked a lot about them being used for membership schemes, for loyalty cards, stuff like that. So Rachel, do you think there's still some outstanding utility left for NFTs?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. I felt like when this article popped up, I thought to myself, yeah, I sort of felt like everyone had forgotten about NFTs because people stopped talking about them because there was, you know, a bit of a crypto market cool down, you know, towards the end of last year and throughout this year. But of course, it doesn't surprise me to discover that they've retained their popularity because they are, well, I think they've retained their popularity because they are, for a number of reasons, some of which are to do with things like democratized access to goods, transparency, fraud prevention. You know, it's all sort of part of that, digital trademark sort of field, and that's you know what the whole point of cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and blockchain technology was all designed to do, right? So, it doesn't surprise me that NFTs are still popular. In terms of their value for brands, I still find it a little bit difficult to wrap my head around this, but I can get why, I can certainly get why a marketer would like anything that is going to potentially add value to their product and to their brand, and things that are associated with authenticity or uniqueness are often going to be able to provide them with that value. So I can see how that's important, but that's only going to be applicable in certain areas, as Sonia mentioned. It's not necessarily going to, you know, give a shampoo brand very much value, and presumably because a shampoo brand also is looking to sell at mass. But luxury goods or particular experience or things like artwork, I can see useful application there. One thing I thought was worth mentioning was at the start of this year when we were visiting Singapore, chatting with lots of people in the marketplace there in preparation for ATS later in the year, we had a really good pre-event with a couple of speakers, one of whom was IPG's CEO, Lee Terry, who presented his thoughts on, you know, trends, emerging trends for 2023 and what benefit they potentially had for marketers. And he brought up an example of proof of concept NFTs that were being associated with luxury goods that were able to effectively give a brand an understanding of demand before a product was even available to buy. So this was very much in the luxury category. And the idea was, I can't remember the specific example he gave, but the idea is, imagine it's a luxury, a new edition, a new release of a luxury watch or something like that. And you can attach an NFT to the right to purchase that watch, because let's say only 10 editions are going to be made in the world. And so you start an NFT that gives people the opportunity to sign up for the proof for the right to purchase the watch, and then together with that you get the opportunity to purchase it when it comes along, and then you get this authenticity, proof of authenticity. And you know, it all sounded a bit spurious to me because I'm not in the market for luxury watches, but I sort of understood the intrinsic brand value behind that and the benefit that could potentially bring to a marketer. I think it's a bit altruistic right now, but I think it could become much more real, you know, as our lives become more digitized, and also as we start to acquire things in more of a digital environment. I'm thinking here more complex, virtual reality worlds, and you know, really complex gaming environments where people build and create houses and lives. So I can sort of see where it's going.
Yeah, I think you've both hit on really interesting points there in terms of, you know, it's gone from the bubble, and all of a sudden every brand was thinking, oh no, we need to have an NFT quickly, we need to get on this, before realizing actually it's not of that much use, where in fact, you know, luxury fashion brands, sports apparel, sports teams and stuff have actually found a real utility for it. And maybe that's it, just a leveling out of the playing field of what it's actually useful for.
Yeah. And don't forget that, you know, sometimes with products, you know, whether they're consumer products or whether they're high-end, you know, works of art, there is a marketplace in owning it, not really doing very much with it, waiting for it to accrue value and then selling it on again. That happens with trainers. You know, people buy trainers, don't wear them, keep them pristine, and then sell them on in 12 months' time because they're limited edition or they've got some other kind of intrinsic value to them. So I think that's what NFTs tap into, is that marketplace of buying and selling associated with value, which can sometimes be interpretive.
Yeah.
I think there's something really interesting, because then NFTs become, you know, kind of like objects you can own in a way. So you sell, you buy it, you trade in it, all of those things come together. And then for more mainstream marketers where they're looking at experiences, how do NFTs play into those spaces of creating experiences, or, you know, access to experiences beyond just the ownership of it? So those become kind of an interesting space, especially when one of the examples was as a ticket for an event, but then it has a limited value at that point in time, right? And the value also changes depending on whether it's before the event, after the event, is it a token, is it an object, is it a ticket? All of those things come into play. So it's going to be very important for marketers to put the right lens on what that NFT is meant to be and how to value it. And that's going to be the most important part.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think the question of accessibility is an interesting one as we, you know, we look at global businesses and sports, for example. You can be, you could be a huge Liverpool fan who lives in Singapore and you can't be a season ticket holder, but there's an NFT that could give you access to the club, to decisions made in the club, it's more than a membership scheme. It's been very useful for that. We talked to George Tertois, who works for Alchemy in the UK. And he was talking about, you know, the utility of NFTs for sports teams earlier in the year with me. And it's fascinating in an area, you know, like it's, like I say, my intro may have been a bit snarky regarding NFTs. Yes, it's interesting to see how they'll be used and how they are adopted going forward beyond the terrible pictures that were sold for millions of pounds. That's the end of our stories. That's the end of the news section for this week. Before we wrap up, Sonia, I just wanted to throw the floor to you, really. Tell us, how's everything going in Singapore? How's life at Dentsu?
I think Singapore is bustling, right? It's the end of the year. And honestly, starting from October, the number of posts I've seen from friends and colleagues across the industry about, okay, and Q4 has hit. Now we just have to survive Q4 and then we're going to have the new year, you know? So that's kind of where this thing is coming in. being a regional hub, there's so much about, you know, what are we going to do, budgets, this, activations, last minute things, and what you need to finish off for the year. I think that's a common situation right across every business in Singapore, not just agencies, and everybody's in that same space. But I think everybody's looking forward to what it might mean and how you close out the year, because that sets the tone for the next year. So it's going to be good fun.
What's your perception, Sonia, of the sort of economic landscape? You know, I always feel much more sort of enthusiastic and buoyant about the global economy when I'm in Asia, because I feel like, you know, things are not quite as gloom and doom as they are in parts of Europe or have been throughout the year. I'm not saying it's all been gloom and doom. It's certainly been up and down. And when we were there in October, I was really getting a feeling of, sort of cautious optimism for 2024. Would that be a reasonable way to characterize it?
I'll definitely say that it is cautious optimism, but across most Southeast Asia markets, everybody who is running these businesses are also individuals with their own wallets and their own purses and their own expenses and things like that. So when you look at what people are, you know, saying about how they feel about the outlook on the world, everybody is worried about the buying power that they can get, you know. So, and with that, you find, the people are tightening their wallets. They are going more, you know, like to generic products, white label products. You're seeing a distinct shift in how consumers are behaving in those spaces. And that is taking a toll on brands quite a bit. So, you know, how brands have to work a lot more harder to communicate their value to consumers is a really big thing that a lot of brands are talking about and trying to deal with. And defining that value, because all of a sudden, the consumer is evaluating it not in the strength of the relationship, but also in terms of what am I going to get back from this in terms of hard benefits or hard cash or, you know, something that is quantifiable in a way. And quantifiable is really important for them these days.
Yeah. And I would have thought as well that, you know, that is the sort of headline of having to do more with less could perhaps characterize marketers and their budget position for this year. But I'd have thought that some of that will be deeply connected to some of the stories that we've talked about here this morning, which is how can I actually get more value out of my marketing budget with either the same amount of resource or different type of resource, my resource structured differently or looking differently, or I've got different type of talent within my team to try to execute on those budgets. Is that something that you feel is being reflected back to you from the clients that you're working with? And so I'm thinking here about, you know, whether it's brands deciding to do more in-house or deciding to outsource more to their agency partners, or are they using particular tech tools like, you know, any AI tools to try to derive more value from their activities?
Yeah, I would say that there are three things that people are thinking about, talking about, and acting on. One is, of course, transformation. How does my organization need to change to make sure that it's future ready, it's ready for next year, it's ready for the next 5 years and the 5 years ahead, right? The second thing is about effectiveness. Anything that I do, what is the effect it's going to have? How is it adding to my top line? How is it supporting my bottom line? And, you know, can you quantify that? So it comes down to that point as well. And the third thing is anything new that I bring to the table, how is that going to help the first two? That becomes the really big thing, right? And we've always known our Asian marketers, our Asian consumers are largely skeptical. They tend to speak out a lot more when they have a problem versus, you know, in enthusiastic support of something new. It's more like wait and watch that we see that happens a lot in Asia versus actually deciding that, oh, look, the new thing is just out. Let's go adopt it or buy it or try it out kind of a thing, right? I think that happens only in luxury that everybody runs out to go get it. The queues for the iPhone every time are super long in Singapore. Yeah. We know that.
Good point.
Yeah, that's all we have time for today. Sonia, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it, and we'll keep in touch throughout the year. Thanks again.
Yes, thank you guys for having me on. It's been really exciting and this has been great. Thank you.
Great. You're very welcome. And Rachel, thank you as always for joining.
My pleasure. Just about to have a coughing fit, so it's good that we're wrapping up.
Excellent. Well, good luck with that. And by the time you are listening to this, ExchangeWise annual Wires Awards will have taken place. So congratulations to all our winners, and keep in touch with ExchangeWise. We'll see you next week.